and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Our guest today, Tim Duffy, K3LR. He's the Chief Operating Officer of DX Engineering. So sit back, relax, and prepare to enjoy this QSO with Tim Duffy, K3LR. Our guest is Tim Duffy, K3LR. And I know that you got something to do with DX Engineering, don't you?
I do. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at DX Engineering.
There you go. Well, you know what? I'll tell you something. I'm absolutely amazed at that company. Whenever I go to Dayton and I believe Huntsville, I'm not sure. My brain is not totally wired tonight, but I know at the Dayton Hamvention, you guys are usually right in the center of the room with all the other, I guess I want to say, people who were in the center of the room. You have quite a display there, and I could spend hours looking at stuff. So I guess it's eclectic? It's like all kinds of things. I mean, it's not just one type of thing. You guys don't carry just one kind of thing. You carry a number of different kinds of things. And what fascinates me about it is I start looking and I think to myself, God, this is great. You could build an antenna using this. And, you know, I think one of the things that really caught my eye was that your ground system things you have over there. Because I've always wanted to put a ground like under a vertical, you know. And there's this little square you guys sell, and everything's all there. I mean, you can construct it. And today it's so hard to build this kind of stuff on your own, you know, unless you have a metal shop or something. And most hams don't. So it's really convenient when I start looking at all the things you have there. Tell us a little bit about the company.
Well, the company's been around for several years, and I came on board a little over 2 years ago. And we do have an assortment of really cool things to use for your station. Our radio plate is so unique, it's actually patented. And that radio plate, Ted, is in use all over the world. It is used on any vertical you can imagine, from the short verticals all the way up to full-size half-wave and 5/8 wave verticals. We've seen installations that would blow your mind. But one thing we do know, we sell some of the highest quality products in the amateur radio field. We've got, as you pointed out, all sorts of neat and adaptive items for ground systems. We also have one of the world's best preamplifiers for receivers that need preamps, or if you have receiving antennas that need preamps. And, of course, those preamps work across all the amateur and short wave bands, which is nice. We have a lot of multi-band verticals to choose from. Some of them are dedicated to 40 and 80 meters, and some of them can be used on 160 through 10 meters. We have a noise-canceling controller, which allows you to phase two receive antennas together to create directive patterns and noise nulls. It's the best noise-canceling controller on the market. And
that's something that's always fascinated me. I guess you could do it with antennas. What I was thinking about for a long time was taking, and I've actually done this, and it works, but I've wondered why no one else has ever done it. You can take two receivers, you know, and have one, let's just say it's on 75, and you've got one on 3895, and then you take the second receiver and move it up the dial just a little bit, and then take the two outputs of the receivers and take the two hot sides, you know, the two plus sides of the output, and put that across a speaker, okay? And then as you vary the volume, you're only going to get the difference information. So if they're static, it'll be the same on both receivers. You'll hear the exact same static crashes and noises on both receivers at the same time. So then if you have the plus side from one receiver, the plus side from the other receiver, and you bring the volume up to the right point, it'll null out all the lightning and static noise. It's really spooky. I mean, it'll null it all out. And what's left is what individual noise is on either receiver. And as a rule, of course, if there's someone talking, you're going to hear them, and then whatever other non-mutual sounds that the other, if you're on a blank spot on the dial, usually what happens is it just makes the static completely go away. So, you know, you're talking about phasing an antenna, and I'm just wondering if you could not get the same effect from that.
Well, yes, in this case, you can get exactly the same effect, but you don't need two receivers. That's the great thing. You can get that exact same noise-canceling effect using our NCC1 by using an antenna A and an antenna B and then phasing them correctly with amplitude and phase to actually cancel the noise. So you can do exactly what you talked about with two receivers, but now you only need one receiver and the NCC1.
Well, let me ask you this question. Does that affect, or does it have the same effect on transmit? In other words, are you changing phase, or is this just a receive thing?
This is just a receive noise-canceling controller. It doesn't do anything to your transmitter.
Well, you know, I've wondered about that, because I thought, you know, I did that when I was a kid with two receivers, you know, and I thought, I wonder why someone hasn't designed a dual receiver for that reason, you know, where you got two receivers and a way to, you know, to take the audio outputs and just do like a left minus right, I guess is the best way to put it, and out goes the noise. You know, I've wondered about that, but I've never seen it done, and of course it would probably be pretty expensive, but then in the middle of the lightning season, you know, it'd come in handy. But if you can do the same thing with one receiver with this device, that sounds to me like that would be something everybody would want to have in the shack. Because how many times are we in the middle of a conversation with somebody that's running, you know, a G5 RV and 100 watts, and you just can't hear them, especially on like 80? It'd be nice to have something like that where you could just null out the static. That would just be amazing, I think. I'm curious, what does this thing sell for? I mean, are you permitted to talk about prices on things on the radio?
Sure. I mean, it's on our website on dxengineering.com, but it's $599, and it's a very nice looking unit, and there's a full instruction manual. In fact, you can download the instruction manual right from the website, and it's very easy to get set up, and it works from 300 kilohertz to 30 megahertz, and we have a lot of shortwave listeners that actually use the NCC, the noise canceling controller, to mitigate interference, either, you know, on where you have the same frequency being used by more than one shortwave station. You can actually null out the one you don't want to hear and improve the readability and listenability of the shortwave station that you do want to hear. Or if there's, you know, heterodynes or carriers or static crashes even. So, it's great for amateur radio, as you say, you know, on 75 meters for trying to deal with noise. But it's also great for AM broadcast listeners that are trying to, you know, see how many stations they can hear on some of the frequencies that have, you know, 15, 20, 30 stations on them all at the same time in the evening.
Yeah, that would be incredible, because you could, if you could select, if you have 20 stations on one frequency, you'd probably be able to, because of the directional position that those signals are coming in at, then you'd be able to null, you know, in different areas. That would just be, that'd be cool, because you could knock them out. It's just knock them off the dial, you know, so you can hear the one you want to hear. You know, let me ask you this question. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about how DX Engineering got started, you know, whose concept was it? What did you guys first get into, and then, you know, did the the company's direction change any from the time it was conceived?
DX Engineering was started out in Oregon. There was a group of guys out there that were building antennas, and they also made some insulators. And they were getting ready to wind up the company, and it was decided to purchase the company and bring it to Ohio. And it started making insulators, and then soon got involved with making clamps and manufacturing stainless steel and aluminum clamps that can be used to build various yagis or verticals, also with boom to mass plates. So then it quickly progressed to manufacturing items that were not available in the market, like this noise canceling controller. So here, about 6 years ago, that product was introduced, and then a very nice preamplifier, and we've got the RTR1, which allows a guy who's got a transceiver but wants to have an external receive antenna that he doesn't want to transmit on. He just wants to use it to receive on. The RTR1 will allow him to be able to use his transceiver that doesn't have an external receiver antenna port. It'll switch automatically and won't cause any problems. And then we have a whole line of vertical antennas. And Ted, about a year ago, DX Engineering purchased the Butternut line of verticals, and we're manufacturing the Butternut verticals and the Skyhawk tribander at our headquarters in Talmadge, Ohio. And so that's been a tremendous addition to our product line. Butternut had been in business for upwards of 30 years, so there's Butternut verticals all over the world, and we're supporting them with parts, and also, there's a new Butternut owner every day. So, we have a large side of our business is our buy-sell business. So we're a full-line dealer for ICOM and Kenwood and Elinco and MFJ and Ameritron, and 120 total lines are part of the DX Engineering family. So it's a tremendous start from insulators and clamps, and here we are selling just about everything that a ham radio operator could want.
Now I'm going to really go out on a limb here. Did you guys ever have, or did you ever handle a small box that was like an audio processor? In my mind, I'm able to see this thing, and it seems like the name on it is DX Engineering. So I was wondering, has there ever been a company long ago that used the same name, or is that a product that you recall?
Yes, I recall that product. I owned that product as a user back in the middle 1970s.
I'd seen those things. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was an RF speech processor that was available for the Drake C lines and Collins gear, and it was an add-in. Actually, I had a Drake T4XC transmitter, and you would unplug a tube, plug in this socket, and plug the tube on top of this new socket. And what it did was it allowed about a 6 dB increase in single sideband transmitter output. It had filters in it to keep it from being too wide, but it was a thing of magic. And that company was in California. It was DX Engineering. But then the name sat dormant for many years. Then this group of guys that started building antennas and insulators and antenna switches in Oregon picked up the name and started using it again. And then it moved to Ohio.
See, you know what? I'm just old. That's what it is. I can remember stuff like that. Shouldn't. And you know what? I should never admit to it either, But you owned one. So, I guess I kind of put the both of us at risk tonight here talking about this audio processor. Well, did you like it? Was it something that worked really good?
I loved it. It was incredible, and it was a very sought after piece. And it, you know, that was back, you know, transmitters at that time, or transceivers did not have any speech processing in them. And so this was new technology. And of course, anytime you saw that can improve your signal by up to 6 dB, and you said, geez, I got to have that. Now, the problem in the Drake line was that they were using sweep tubes in the output for the final amplifiers. They weren't using 6146s or a real RF tube. So they were using the TV sweep tubes. So you can imagine the life cycle of these TV sweep tubes was really reduced when you were driving them hard like this. So, of course, all of us that had the DX Engineering speech processor would then have fans all over the cabinet, you know, to try and pull the heat away and try and prolong the life of these ill-fated, sweep tubes that were meant to be in television sets.
Well, you know, the Citizens Band linear amplifier market majored in using sweep tubes. I remember this company out of Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, that built a number of linear amplifiers. I think they were called DNA. And they had one. I just remember the one. I think it was the Phantom. I think it had 12 sweep tubes in it. And it would do 500 watts on AM. when I was a young one, I remember those guys. Those were heavy, too. I mean, you would try to work on one. They used to bring those to me to work on, and I did. So, but anyhow, the other thing I was going to say, and I'm not getting too far off the beating path, but do you remember a company by the name of Waters? And the reason why I ask is they had two little devices. One was called the Clipreamp, and the other one was called the Compreamp. They had two of these things. And I was a kid, I always wondered, I thought, what's the difference? What's the Compreamp? What's the Clipreamp? What would be the difference? And, of course, now we know one's a compressor, one's a clipper. But it seemed to me you'd want to use both in tandem. You know, you want to compress the signal a little bit and then clip it. You know, I don't know. But they sold them as separate devices. And I remember I got one. I don't know whatever happened to it. But although it just had a knob on the front and an in and out switch on it, you know. But and I don't know about the sophistication of the circuit. But now the water has built other things. Seems like they had watt meters or dummy loads or something. I don't know, but that's all I remember. I was curious, because we were talking about the audio processor, I just wondered if you happened to remember any of that stuff.
Yes. Yep, that was an important part of amateur radio history, I think.
I was just thinking of what else Waters built or did, but I'm drawing a blank. People out there listening know, I'll get emails, they'll give me the whole thing on them. So anyhow, well, now, okay, let me ask, what, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. It's all about ham radio. We'll be right back with our guest, Tim Duffy, K3LR, the chief operating officer of DX Engineering, right after this. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes, and yet so sensitive and so selective it will blow your mind? I'm talking about the Skywave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the Skywave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a Skywave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you will get the portable, retractable wire antenna absolutely free for mentioning WTWW. So go to their website, seacrane.com. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger, but you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from Amateur Radio Roundtable, the QSO radio show, and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. And we'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSOradioshow.com website. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest, Tim Duffy, K3LR, the Chief Operating Officer of DX Engineering. What right now, I guess I want to say today, would you consider to be the main line of DX Engineering? Now, I know you carry all kinds of things that are made by other people, but you guys have your own stuff that I would consider to be what is unique about DX Engineering. So what all is the what all is the main thing or the main focus on your own individual stuff that you folks either make or supervise its manufacture, and it's kind of exclusive to DX Engineering?
So it would be our what we call our four house brands, Ted. That's DX Engineering, Comtex Systems is also our own manufactured house brand, and then Butternut Antennas and Cycle 24 Clamps. So those are the four main lines. Now, Comtex Systems has a premier line of four square array controllers, and Comtech also has a large line of Ballons. Just about any Ballon that you can imagine, we make in the ComTech brand, and we also make a whole line of Ballons in DX Engineering. The DX Engineering Ballons are typically in aluminum or stainless steel boxes, where the ComTech Ballons are in plastic weather-proof boxes. But, you know, there can be some cost differences for somebody who is on a budget and looking to get a high-quality piece. We sell all the transformers for beverage antennas. We have an 8-circle receiving array that allows you to set up 8 verticals, and you can rotate it electronically in 8 different directions and create, you know, it has 25 to 30 dB of front-to-back ratio. So we have some really good high-performance products that are meant for amateur radio operators that really want to get down and work DX and have a lot of efficiency to them. The other thing is we have a whole line of coax. You know, we've got RG213. We have 400 Max, which is a really high-quality coax. We have our own patented connector that is used with the 400 Max that allows the center conductor to be soldered, and the shield, of course, on the 400 Max, it's similar to LMR 400. It has a foil shield and a braided shield, and the only way to make sure that you install the connector properly is that that has to be crimped, not soldered, and so we have the best of both worlds. It's silver-plated, crimped on the shield, soldered on the center conductor, and we pre-make cables too, so you know you can leave the soldering and the crimping to us, and we'll ship you the length that you want. We sell masts, high-quality 22-foot-long masts, 2-inch and 3-inch, that are hot-dip galvanized, and we have a mast load estimator on our website, so you can figure out if your antenna loads are properly placed before you go and buy them. You know, we sell guy wire and Philly strand guy wire as well. So, like I said before, we really do manufacture a unique line of products that you can't buy anywhere else, and then we augment them with some of the, you know, the favorite products that you might find at other dealers. But I think, Ted, really, the big difference with DX Engineering is we have a staff of well-experienced ham radio operators that have 20, 30, 40, 50 years individually of experience that answer the phones every day and give great advice. And, you know, these days where the Elmers are kind of distributed all over the place, we do a lot of Elmering on the phone to help guys get started or if they have questions. So we've really got a very knowledgeable staff of people that can help guys just about with any question that they have, whether it's, you know, getting on FM or getting on digital modes or doing RIDI or even working CW. You know, we've got it covered.
Well, you know, I guess what's really strange is when I was much younger, I'd go to put up an antenna. Like, for example, an inverted V, you know, and you lived in a neighborhood and you just go out and get a mast. I mean, you go down to, you could pick them up at Ace Hardware or something, you know, and you pick up like 2 or 3 sections of this really cheap mast. And you'd put it on the roof and guy it off and put you a pulley up there and pull your inverted V up. You have the apex up, you know, above the house by 30 feet or so, you know, and boy, it worked like a champ. Well, what's funny now is you can't find mast anywhere. Someone was asking me, how would you do that? I said, well, there used to be a mount you could put on the roof, and then the mast would go in the mount, and then you just simply, you know, tie it off with some guy wire and then put your dipole on top of there, or your inverted V. And we were hunting everywhere. We couldn't find any mast anywhere. So I thought, you know, where do you get that? And someone said, well, I think DX Engineering sells that stuff. And I thought, well, and of course I didn't get that far. But when you just got done talking about mast and telescoping mast, so you must have a whole line of that stuff.
We do. You know, Ted, we stock aluminum tubing in sizes all the way from 3/8 of an inch outside diameter up to 3 inches. and we've got it in various lengths, and if you want it slitted, so you can make a mast out of that very easily, a telescoping mast. Or we've got fiberglass tubing in various lengths, and we even sell a fiberglass mast that you can use for putting up your dipole antennas. And then, you know, we have the old standby, the Rhone push-up masts, just like you used to buy at Ace Hardware or at Radio Shack, and we have those in stock as well. So if somebody's looking for a mast, we've got it.
Now, is that the kind that has the rings that you can, you know, you start putting it up section after section, you tighten the ring down, and that ring has a place for guying on it. And I don't know, I've seen those. I've never owned a mast like that because I always had the cheap ones from Ace Hardware. but I was wondering, is that what those are when you're talking about Rhone?
Yes. Yeah, it's the same, very same idea. You has the rings to lock it in, and you just push it up and away. We even have the guy rings that you can put there and rope to do, you know, if it's a field day installation or a temporary installation, and then, you know, Ted, sometimes a temporary installation becomes permanent.
Oh, yeah. I've been there before. We had all came up, but you sell aluminum tubing, like for what you would actually build an antenna out of. When I say an antenna, let me qualify that. In other words, let's go back to Citizens Band days, and let's go back to, I guess Martin Jew wound up buying high gain, but they used to put out a 5/8 wave antenna that was... I think they called it the CLR2. So it had radials. I think it had three radials, and it was 5/8 wave with some little tiny capacitive hat at the top, you know, and everything. But all that type of tubing, if you wanted to take on a project and try to build something like that yourself, you folks have all of that, don't you?
Yeah, we have it all, Ted. You know, all the clamps that go along with it, so the aluminum tubing, the clamps, the plates that it takes, the coax, you know, the double SO239 coax chassis type mount that you can put up there along with the antenna. We've got all those materials, and, you know, and it's very easy to find on the website. And we have a 120 page catalog that we just sent out at Dayton time, and we gave it away at Hamvention, but you know, we send them all over the world, and I'll tell you that there's all the charts and graphs of the various aluminum tubing and the rope and all the coax and everything that it takes to, you could roll your own 5/8 wave antenna for 10 meters without any problem at all.
Just out of curiosity, what do you think it would cost to build a 5/8 wave 10 meter antenna? I'm just off. I mean, no, don't go calculating out, you know, but I mean, just ballpark. What do you think you could do it for? Everything so that it's ready to clamp onto a mast and hook the coax to it.
I bet you could do it for under $100.
Yeah, I know, because I was curious because the big holdup, we used to try to build antennas out of conduit, and the problem with conduit is so heavy, you know, so you really got to beef up your support system, you know, and I don't know with, but I guess that the conduit is it galvanized? I don't know what it is. It's got that funny finish to it. And I've kind of wondered about its, you know, its conductivity, if it was actually, you know, good for antennas or not. Now, they claim some things are and some things aren't, but aluminum tubing is supposed to be pretty good.
It is. It is. And it's lightweight and strong. And the big thing is you don't have to have a monster support to hold up, you know, this kind of tubing. It's meant for, you know, antenna construction. So, and we keep a ton of it in stock. So, you know, if you decide by 10 o'clock tonight that you want to place an order for tubing, we'll have it on a truck before midnight, and it's out the door. So,
wow.
You know, that's the kind of thing we do. Yeah.
So what do you folks make? I know there's got to be stuff there because I'm looking at the booth. What do you make that interfaces towers? With people who are tower owners, now all of a sudden they want to do something different or strange or whatever. What do you folks make that goes hand in hand with the tower owner?
You know, we make several things. One of the things that you may have seen at Dayton this year, Ted, we just introduced a new clamp set called the Genius Clamp. And this allows a tower owner, he could be Rhone 25 or 45 or an AN wireless tower or any of those towers, it allows a side mount. So if you wanted to have like a 2-meter antenna or a 440 antenna, or any kind of vertical, or you wanted to have, you know, your dipole or inverted V, so you could have a pulley set off to the side. The Genius clamps allow you to go right onto the tower legs and then use some aluminum tubing to support antennas off to the side of the tower. So you can make more utility out of an existing tower. And, you know, a lot of times you find guys try to use U-bolts haphazardly or some sort of a hose clamp around the tower leg and a standoff. This makes it real easy. We've done all the work of accumulating all the hardware. It makes the perfect 90-degree turn. So that's really nice for the tower owner. The big thing we're always preaching is the guy's got to make sure that their towers are grounded. And so, you know, we have all the clamps for the base of the tower. We have some studded band clamps that allow you to attach all your ground connections. We got the one-shot CAD welds that go on top of the ground rods. We have a lot of innovative ground rod attachment clamps so that there's no excuse not to have a good grounded tower system. And then, of course, you know, we've got all the things to attach coax to the side of the tower as you're going up the side. And then we talked about masts for the top of the tower, you know, to put inside the rotor and to allow you to put antennas above the top of the tower. All the guying hardware, all the thimbles, all the Crosby clamps, all the preforms, we got it. Soup to nuts.
Let me ask you this question. Do you have anything that would allow a person to shunt feed a tower for use on HF?
We do. We've got just about everything you could need for that. You know, the fiberglass standoff arms. We've got a nice wire, a number 14 wire that you could use for the shunt feed. So you got the standoffs. You got the Genius clamps to hold the standoffs off the side. The only thing that we don't have, Ted, would be that variable capacitor at the bottom. But, you know, of course, you put one of our vertical radial plates down there so that you've got a nice way to connect all the radials because, of course, the shunt-fed tower needs the radials to work correctly. And then we've got all the connection points to allow the transition to a female UHF connector. So you can hook your coax there, but you find one of those nice variable capacitors at the local ham fest or swap meet. And with some DX engineering help, you're in business with the shunt-fed tower.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, why is it, and maybe I'm out of touch, maybe I just don't know. I was going to say, why is it that no one is making those kinds of capacitors? I mean, I used to see big, gigantic caps that were made by Johnson, you know, and all that, and they're getting fewer and fewer at the Ham Fest to find the you know, the split stators and all that kind of stuff. You just don't see them. So I'm just wondering, why isn't somebody, is there just no call for them, or what's the deal? And if there was a call for them long ago, what was it that all these were going into? Because they were pretty plentiful. I mean, you go through I'll go out to Dayton, man, you'd just be all sorts of air variables everywhere.
Yeah, they're still being made. You know, there are companies like Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L was one of the capacitor manufacturers, Johnson and others, and Sprague. And, you know, those things are still around, and they're still being made. But think about, you know, components have changed. The surface mount and solid state, and you don't need... you know, the call for big high voltage variables has drastically changed because now we're, you know, use 50 volts to power our you know, the amplifiers instead of, you know, 2,500 or 3,000 volts. So I think it's, you have to look in different places, but that's the great thing about the internet. You know, you see, you just Google variable capacitor or error variable, and you're still going to find places that have them. But they'll be more expensive than what you and I remember 30 and 40 years ago, that's for sure.
Well, I'm going to ask a stupid question. Can I do that?
Sure.
Okay. You've got the box that you said will allow you to use a separate receive antenna on a transceiver. So you key down, you're transmitting on one antenna, you let off on the microphone, and you're back to, now you're on to something else, okay? Assuming that that box has probably been used a lot for beverage antennas, and I don't know how much you're into antenna theory, but my question is, do people ever transmit off of a beverage?
No, they would never. And that question has been asked before. And just to preface, I am very much into antenna theory. You may want to take a peek at my website, k3lr.com. The beverage antenna, while very good for being a low noise, directive receive antenna, is actually about minus 30 dB, minus 25 dB of gain. So that would be not the kind of thing you'd want to use to transmit into.
Well, the reason why I say this is when I lived, I was at a location in Michigan where I lived, and I had a, 600 feet? 600 feet, maybe 700 feet, I can't remember. Long wire antenna. Well, I guess that would classify as a beverage, would it not?
Well, if it was about 10 or 12 feet above the ground and aimed at the direction that you wanted to receive from, it would be a beverage.
Okay, so that basically what it was. It might have been as high as 15 feet off the ground. I don't think it was any higher than that. And the thing I experienced with it was really strange. I had a little box. I'm trying to think of the company's name. It just said Unique Wire Tuner on it. And it had, if I remember right, what did it have? A capacitor, maybe, and a roller inductor. That's it. And I connected the antenna to that, and it did. It had a great low noise receive, but I transmitted on it. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I could work Great Britain every night on that antenna. I mean, without fail. It didn't matter what the band conditions were. Well, I wouldn't say totally, but it was not like it was subjected to hit and miss or something like that. If it was 2 in the morning, you were on the air at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, you got on that antenna, and you'd make contacts all over Europe. And I never did figure that out. I thought, well, is it just a long wire? You know, what's the designation between a long wire and a beverage, and why do you never hear anybody talking about transmitting on a beverage? And I thought, well, you know, this has got to be a stupid question, so I'm going to ask the stupid question, because it just blew me away. I used to have guys come over just to watch this antenna work, you know, and the guy, one friend of mine said, well, 20 meters last night was dead. I said, well, I may have been, but I was talking all over Europe. And he said, well, it couldn't have been. He said, he had a cubicle quad up for 20 meters, and he was, you know, doing whatever you do, however you aim it, you know, when you do the great circle or whatever. So he was dead on Europe and couldn't hear a thing. And so he came over, and, you know, he sat there with his jaw down. And this was nothing that I had, wasn't no big deal to me. It was just something I threw together. I put this 700-foot wire up just to see what it would do. And, of course, that's one of the things ham radio is about. You know, it's doing something crazy to see if it'll work, you know. So, if you're into antenna theory, tell me what was going on there, because it really threw me. I mean, I had people, at that time I lived in Saginaw, but I had guys driving in from Detroit, you know, some 90 miles away to look at this or see this work, because they didn't believe me.
Well, you know, it's tough to say. Typically, a beverage would have a resistor at the end of it.
A termination, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. It would have a resistor to a ground rod, you know, typically in the 500 ohm area. So without any termination, that was just a long wire that was 15 feet off the ground. And it would have been interesting if you had, you know, even a dipole or a two or three element beam at the same location at the same time to have been able to switch back and forth.
I did. You know, I had an inverted V, which was basically a quarter wavelength on each side that was there for 20. And when I would switch to that, everything would disappear. You heard nothing. Now, you could hear if there was somebody on stateside and they were closer in. Let's say that the band was open and you'd hear somebody from Pennsylvania or maybe Colorado. And you'd flip over back to that long wire and they just disappear. And all you would hear would be these stations coming in from Europe. It was just really weird.
Now, that's great. Well, you know, every once in a while, it's the right combination of things, you know, height and length and the QTH and what's in the ground and all those sorts of things. So it sounds like you hit the jackpot, Ted.
Yeah, well, like I said, it was just put together on a lark. And actually, what I had put it together for was for broadcast band reception. I thought, you know, because if you're starting to, I mean, you know, what, 560 kilohertz is a pretty long wavelength, so I figured a 700-foot wire would be, you know, what I would need if I wanted to really get real good reception on AM. But, you know, back then, you know, I had a lot of crazy stuff going through my head, you know. So, but that was why, and I don't know, we just got to playing with it one night, and a friend of mine was over, and we tuned that unique wire tuner on 20. That's 700 feet. I wonder how many wavelengths that would be. I guess that you could probably calculate the gain it had, could you not? Or is that, I'm sure there's a formula for that somewhere. It's over my head, but nonetheless. So I thought it's got to be. But, you know, like, for example, we work a lot with rhombics on shortwave broadcast. And most of the stations here in the United States do not terminate their rhombics. They have a rhombic that's unterminated, which would give you, you know, like a clover leaf pattern, really. But I've been kind of amazed at that. Of course, now if you terminate one of them, you're stuck in one direction, and that's it. You know, I mean, that's where you're going. And although it's really fascinating, all this stuff about antennas is extremely fascinating. And things that I wanted to do is I've always wanted to put a couple of dipoles up and then rig something up to where you can phase them, you know, so you can put them in phase, out of phase, and play with them. And I suppose you guys have all that stuff to do that with.
We do. We actually, you know, have the phase boxes that allow you to do that, so that you can put two dipoles that are fed with the same length of coax and create patterns with them. So, yeah, there's it's just almost limitless the things you can do to experiment with antennas. And it's a good thing that experimentation continues. And, you know, we have not figured it all out yet. We have figured out some stuff, but I think there's a whole lot of stuff that we haven't even touched yet. And that's the great thing about this hobby, and that's why we're all in it. You know, it's you just don't know what you're going to trip on next, or the guys that you talk to might give you an idea, and you go, you know, and it doesn't cost a lot of money. You know, that 700-foot long wire didn't cost very much at all.
No, matter of fact, back then it was really cheap, you know. The price of copper was, you know, nothing, you know. The only thing was I made two or three attempts at it, and the problem I had was I didn't get the wire big enough, so it'd stretch, you know, and so I had to get some pretty, pretty thick wire, and then I had to have some supports in the center, which really weren't problems because we had an orchard in the back, you know, and I just ran the thing back there and tied it up in all these apple trees as it went along, and they went forever. I mean, those things went, I bet it was a half a mile of apple trees. So, It stayed about 15 feet off the ground, yeah. That is the... Let me say, okay, you're into antenna theory, so now let's talk about this. I had John Stanley on, who basically wrote the book on DRM on shortwave, And he spent 20 years at HCJB in Quito, Ecuador. And they credit, I think they credit the fella, and I can't remember the name now, but one of the engineers there, they credit him for the creation of the cubicle quad. Do you know anything about that story?
I do. Yeah, I'm quite familiar with why they did it and how they did it, and that was pretty amazing stuff.
Well, tell me about, I assume you folks carry everything you need if a person wants to build a cubicle quad.
Yeah, we do. You know, we've got the booms, so the 2-inch boom that you might need if you want to build a 2-element cubicle quad, you know, it's pretty easy. And you talk about a cost-effective directive antenna. It's hard to beat the quad. The fiberglass spreaders, we've got the fiberglass, we've got a spreader hub, and you know, we actually sell a derivative of that. It's our hex beam, so it's sort of like a quad laid on its side, and the wires are put together such that it's a directive Yagi, but it looks like a quad on the side, kind of pulled up. But all the things that you need to build a single element or a 2-element quad, you know, where you could put all the wires. We have all the wires and all the clamps that you would need to attach the wires to the fiberglass spreaders. So you could have 20, 17, 15, 12, and 10 meters. So Ted, you could have 5 bands, and they could all be fed right off a single feed point. We have the 50 to 100 ohm transformer, and that's a balanced 100 ohms to a 50 ohm unbalanced, you know, coaxial feed. You put all those wires together like that, put the reflector is somewhere between 4 and 5% longer. And there you go. It's, you know, for a couple $100 and some time spent putting it together, you can roll your own. And there's nothing like putting up your own antenna and saying, you know what? I built that sucker, and it works.
Well, let me ask you this question now. With the quad, aren't you talking about something that's going to be a lot lighter weight than its equivalent in a beam?
It is, but there's two things that are a little bit unique about that quad. You know, it takes some real finagling to work around guy wires. So if you've got a guide tower and you want to put that quad up there, you've got to really do some thinking to safely do that. Now, if you have a crank-up tower or a self-supporting tower, then that's not as bad a problem. The only other thing you have to worry about is in some of the areas, you might have ice trouble. And icing on those wires and ice on the fiberglass spreaders, you know, coming from the Saginaw area, that can put a real strain on a quad. But, boy, there's a lot of advantages to quads. And, you know, you talk about things that were kind of popular 25 years ago was the quad. You don't see too many. Gem Quad is still out there and a couple of others. Boy, I'll tell you, you don't hear a lot about quads today just because they're a little tough to put up on guide towers.
I guess the other question is performance-wise, have you ever ran a quad on a number of the bands and had a chance to play with one and see what it would do?
I have. Back when I was in high school, I had a high quad. This was the high gain 2-element quad. And that antenna, I thought, worked very well. You know, an 8-foot boom and was on 20, 15, and 10, fed with a single feed. And I thought it worked really well. And I thought I was able to compete pretty well on those bands against guys running, you know, 3- and 4-element tri-banders, the TA-33s or the TH-3s. So, and Wayne Overbeck, N6NB, had written some articles in Ham Radio Magazine back in the 70s where he went out on the beaches of California and set up quads and set up beams. And, you know, this was before all the fancy antenna modeling and all that sort of stuff. And he really, that gave the quad a shot in the arm. It really stood up and performed very well.
Well, I was wondering because I had someone tell me that they had made a two-element quad for 20 meters, and I think they made another one for 15 on the same structure. And the the spider, the bamboo rods that come out, you know, the way that spider web kind of arrangement gave them the ability to ascertain the distance and how, in other words, they were able to make the 15-meter quad exact on the inside of the 20-meter quad because of the way the elements taper coming down, or not that, but the bamboo rods or whatever you're using that comes down. It comes in an X format, so you just make that one smaller and at the right distance, so you got, it's actually, you know, perfect for 15. Anyhow, what they were saying is that that it outperformed a four element beam that they had actually, you know, they had them set up on two towers and they were A-B-ing the things. I don't know how. I guess that's like ham radio on steroids. But they were able to go back and forth, and the two element quad would outperform the four element beam. And what they said the reason was was because of the shape of the quad, you had both elements of polarization at the same time. Even though if you feed it, I can't remember, if you feed it at the bottom, you've either got horizontal or vertical. If you feed it at the side, you have horizontal or vertical, which I can't remember which is which. But then I got to thinking about it. I thought, well, if you feed it on the side, and let's say that, okay, let me ask you, what do you have if your feed point is on the side? Is that vertical or horizontal polarization?
Well, it depends upon whether you have it in a square configuration where the where you have the elements parallel, you know, two of the sides are parallel to the ground, or if it's fed in a diamond or positioned in a diamond configuration, that can actually, you know, change it. So, and you'll find quads done both ways. You'll find them as squares or cubes or even triangles. So, you know, there's two parts to it, where you feed it and what the configuration is. You know, but the classic way that Hi-Gain did it, which was horizontally polarized, was to have it in a diamond configuration where the spreaders were actually parallel to the ground, and then it was fed at the bottom of the one part of the square on its side. And that was horizontally polarized. But, you know, for the most part, horizontal polarization on the 20, 17, 15, 12, and 10-meter bands is what you want for using the ground to get ground gain. And once you get into the ionosphere, everything rotates anyway, you know, and it goes from vertical to horizontal and vertical. But there's been a lot of guys that have run vertically polarization and horizontal polarization. Sometimes one is better than the other. And that's another great thing about antennas is, unless you've got them too close together where they're coupling, you can't have too many of them. And it's great to be able to have an antenna switch that allows you to choose what the best antenna is for a given situation. And it's, you know, there's a big line of variables there.
You know, I guess, okay, so what happens on a cubical quad if you wind up with vertical polarization? What are you experiencing there?
Well, you know, that would be actually a better antenna, I would think, for ground wave communication, maybe even for scatter communication, but definitely, you know, in fact, I have a 10-meter net that I talked to in Pittsburgh, which is about 65 miles away from me, and the vertically polarized antennas on 10 meters are much better for ground wave communication. So vertical polarization is good for that, but it is when, you know, most of my antenna systems here are concentrating on working DX stations outside of the U.S. And I do have some vertical arrays that are ground mounted. Of course, they're vertically polarized, and they're four square arrays, so they've got gain to them and everything. But the Yagis that are horizontally polarized always have better signal strengths.
Yeah, it's really weird because in the back in the day on Citizens Band, there was an antenna company called Avanti, I think was the name of it. And they made this antenna, they called it a polar diversity loop. Anyways, it was a cubical quad with dual feed points. You could select either vertical or horizontal. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those things. But it was really weird because I remember listening, and you'd drop it to horizontal, and some signals would pick up, others would drop, go the other way, just the opposite. Some would pick up, and some would go away, just depending on who you wanted to talk to. And I always thought that was strange. I thought, well, you know, it just seemed to me that horizontal would be the desired polarization. And so how would you have some Citizens Band stations, how would you have some horizontally polarized, and how would you have some vertically polarized? Or would that just be the way the atmosphere rolls the signal over?
It is. You know, as long as those signals on 11 meters were being propagated through the ionosphere, then a lot of times it really doesn't matter. But however, a lot of Citizens Band stuff was done, you know, within 10, 15, 20 miles, where the vertical polarization was much better. And look, a lot of these guys were in mobiles too, and that's vertically polarized. So if you're not using the ionosphere, which in that case, this is all ground wave, 15, 20, 25 miles, that vertical polarization was the way to go. If you had that Avanti switched to horizontal and you were trying to work a mobile that was 15 miles away, there'd be drastic difference between horizontal and vertical polarization on that Avanti antenna.
I guess the other thing that I was kind of wondering about that goes in the same line, can you tell me what is the difference, the significant difference, between running a vertical, like, say, for example, on the 40-meter band, versus a dipole? I know a lot of guys run verticals, and some of them say that they're a lot better for working really long distances. And then I've also heard the opposite. I've heard people say, well, I use a vertical even for close-up stuff. So what have you found? You're an antenna guru, so you're the guy I want to talk to here about this.
Well, you know, and I've got both a horizontal and vertical antennas here for 40 meters, so I feel I'm really in a good spot to give you not only the theory, but most importantly, some practical experience on that. And the horizontal antenna, so a dipole or an inverted V, let's just take a dipole of 30 feet off the ground on 40 meters, is a very, very effective antenna for communicating in a 500-mile to 1,000-mile area. It's probably the best antenna you could have for doing that kind of communication. The vertical antenna has a lower takeoff angle, and as long as you've got suitable radials, you know, a good radial system underneath it, that vertical is efficient for actually communication in the 1,000 to 3,000 mile area. And it's not very good right overhead, because there's a quarter wave vertical has a deep null overhead. So, you know, the vertical has a lower takeoff angle, has the null overhead, where the 30-foot-high dipole has not much radiation at the lower angles, which are good for DX communication, but it's got a very high-angle lobe, which is better for the close-in stuff. So it depends upon what you want to work, and as we've been talking, you know, it's good to have both, Ted.
Well, I wondered, because I've talked to guys that swear that nothing outperforms a vertical in terms of operating, especially like 17 meters, 15 meters. And but then I'm thinking, you know, a 10 meter vertical on the ground, you know, if it's a, even if it's a 5/8 wave, that thing's only, you know, 20 feet tall. So, you know, I've wondered about height. I mean, how does height affect all these things? I mean, I know, you know, when I was a kid, the big trick was we wanted to put the antenna of any kind up just as high as you could get it, you know. And I remember putting dipoles up and just about killing myself to get another 2 feet out of it, as if that was going to make a difference, you know. So what, I mean, how is it with verticals? I mean, you have a radial system underneath it, but can you actually get great performance, let's say on 10 meters with a 5/8 wave vertical sitting on the ground?
You can. I wouldn't call it great performance, but you can get decent performance. But unfortunately, it's not going to be competitive even with a three-element Yagi, because that 5/8 wave might on its best day have 3 dB a gain. You know, it's omnidirectional. It's 3 dB a gain. But the three-element Yagi is going to have, over ground, it's going to have upwards of 8 dB, 9 dB a gain, and it's directive. So, you know, they both, if that Yagi is up in the air a little bit, 30, 40 feet, it's going to have a fairly good or low takeoff angle. That 5/8 wave vertical, you know, it doesn't look like much, but again, on its best day, it can only have 3 dB a gain. So it's not going to stack up as well. I've got a four-square array on 10 meters that we use because we can switch it in four different directions very quickly with its relay switching. But we've got a seven-element 10-meter beam that's aimed on South America at 50 feet. And, you know, the South American station will be S9 on the seven-element beam, and it's S5 on that four-square array. And, you know, those are just facts of physics and game.
Well, let's jump the gun here for a minute, and let's talk about mobile antennas. Now, do you folks, I guess you sell stuff that a guy can build anything out of, but do you do much in that field?
You know, we can help you build mobile antennas, roll your own for like 6 and 10 meters, but most of the guys are using the Hustler whips for mobile antennas. We do have some screwdriver antennas from MFJ, and I have a Tar Heel that I use mobile, and I'm on 80 through 6 meters with my ICOM IC7000, and primarily CW in the car. So we can help you there. But as far as making your own, it's, you know, because the coils are needed for the lower frequency bands such as 20 and 40, and, you know, it doesn't adapt itself well to doing homebrew there, Ted.
Well, you know, I've seen these, what do they call them now? I'm trying to think. They're the black whip antennas that have the little insert at the top. You can fine-tune them, I guess. What are they called?
Hamsticks.
Hamsticks. Okay, there you go. Yeah, so I've seen the hamsticks, and I talked to some folks that said, well, they work really good. I tried one. I couldn't get one to work very good. But anyways, then a fellow says, well, you didn't have the matching coil at the bottom. So then I talked to other guys that say, well, yeah, with the matching coil, it does all right. And I heard other people say, I've never used one of those matching coils, and mine works fine. What's the story on that?
Well, you know, it's like a lot of things. There's variables there, you know, depending upon whether all the metal in the vehicle is bonded together. And these matching coils can be a make or break from an SWR standpoint. And so a lot of times a guy will have some SWR and his radio starts folding back and reducing power, and that can be a problem. So I don't have any direct experience with the ham sticks, but I know on the Tar Heel there's a little shunt coil that you got to have at the bottom or it doesn't work right.
Well, my son Matt has the large Tar Heel on the back of his Volvo, and then in the trunk, one thing about the Tar Heel is at least you can run a little power on it. I think, well, he's got a homebrew amplifier in the trunk and a couple, three car batteries, and I don't know what all else, but I think that thing will put out about, it's a KW. It's a legal box in the trunk of the car, carrying that around. And going into the Tar Heel, and the signal coming off that car is amazing. I mean, I've heard it all over the country when he's been traveling, and it just blows your mind. You couldn't believe it's a mobile. I've wondered about that. Now, I had an experience where we went on a trip, and we had a pickup truck that we actually had leased. And so I got the idea. I wanted to put, mobile rig in the car. So we had an Elenco DX70 and the EDX2. And we put four poles in the back bed of the truck. They were just wooden poles that went up about, I don't know, far high enough to where you, you weren't going to hit an underpass. You wouldn't be able to go through a drive-in through Hamburger Joint, but you could, you wouldn't hit an overpass, but you could get just about everywhere else. Anyways, we took wire and drilled holes through the wood dowel things going up in the air. They were about an inch round, maybe. And I don't even know where we got them. Seems like we got a long, we had to cut two or three things in half or something, but we had four poles. Drilled holes and made like a helical antenna. We went through one and to the other one and then up a little bit to the next one and then just kind of wound it up. So there was a kind of a coil. And it probably wrapped around four or five times. And then connected it to the EDX2 then, which was grounded to the chassis of the vehicle. And it was amazing. It was just absolutely amazing. It blew me away how well that antenna worked. So then the idea came to me. I thought, well, I wonder why we don't use wire antennas mobile. Like, for example, you could create something like that that would go from the back end to the front end of a vehicle. A big square, it'd look crazy. But hams don't care if antennas look crazy. I mean, we just after performance. And so I'm wondering a little bit about that. Have you ever heard of people doing things like this?
Oh, yeah. No, there's no end to the experimentation that goes
on. And do you sell anything that would allow a person to mount a wire antenna, say, from the trunk of the car all the way up to the front or, some configuration like what we had where you could run an antenna tuner to it? I mean, I'm just curious if you sell anything like that.
Well, we've got all sorts of clamps that you can use and hardware and poles and things. So, it's not an off-the-shelf item, but with a little imagination, we can help you get there.
Is it why is that not done? Is there some specific reason you can think of as to why hams don't use wire antennas on cars like that? Is it because of wind resistance? I mean, this thing worked perfectly. We never had a bit of trouble out of it.
Well, it's not elegant. And it's tough to get the wife to accept it. So, and it's not simple. A lot of people call us up and say, send me a Hustler whip for 20 meters and give me the mounting hardware. I got to get it on the vehicle because we're going on vacation in 3 days. They don't want to be fooling around with it.
Oh, I guess that's true, too. It's pre-made, ready to go. Well, let me ask you this question now. In antenna theory, I may be entering into some dangerous territory here, but how do you compare, say, for example, the 75-meter Hustler against an antenna like the Tar Heel?
Well, it all comes down to physical size, and the 75-meter Hustler may be just a little shorter than the Tar Heel. The other thing about the Tar Heel, the coil that is used in the Tar Heel is a larger diameter coil. It has larger wire, and they're both negative gain antennas. They're not full size, not even close to full size. So the idea is to get something that the transmitter will accept having a low SWR across a few kilohertz. The great thing about Tar Heel is, you know, being it's a screwdriver, we can move it very easily and move around the band. But I would give the edge to the Tar Heel, but it's not going to be night and day. You know, the Tar Heel has a little lower lower loss coil and a little bit more stinger out of the top. So I would give the edge there, but, you know, it's sort of like being the tallest midget in the bar.
Well, it's like, I guess the other thing, too, there was always the, you used to hear a lot about bug catchers. I don't hear much about them anymore. Is that antenna still around? Is that something people still do?
Yeah, I still see, you know, I think it was WD4BUM and all these. There are, you know, the Texas bug catcher. They're still around, and if you Google them, you know, you can still end up with them. And it's a game of reducing losses. So higher Q, lower loss coils are going to give you more signal. But there are some physics at work here, and there's no free lunch. So it's tough to, you know, in a small physical size, really out trick the losses that are going on. But some of those bug catchers deliver very, very good signals. Again, they're not as elegant. They're not as pretty.
Well, I guess there was another antenna. Gosh, I can't think of the name of it now. It's on the tip of my tongue, but it would be a competitor to bug catcher and a competitor to Tar Heel. You know who I'm talking about. I can't. It just isn't there. I can see one of them.
Outbacker or...
Well, that doesn't... I don't know. But they were pretty... They were in the game. I remember seeing those, a lot of those antennas here and there. They didn't look as stout as the Tar Heel. And the only reason I would even mention that is because over a period of time, going down the road and all the things an antenna encounters... I mean, you want some ruggedness there because you're gonna need it, or else that antenna is gonna come off. And that was the only thing that I noticed about those other antennas that didn't seem to have the solidness to them. Of course, that solidness, I'm sure, I'm just gonna guess and say the solidness costs a little extra. You know, you're gonna pay for the construction on one of those things. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. It's all about ham radio. We'll be right back with our guest, Tim Duffy, K3LR, the Chief Operating Officer of DX Engineering, right after this. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger. But you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from Amateur Radio Roundtable, the QSO radio show, and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham. And then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. And we'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSOradioshow.com website. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you will get the portable, retractable wire antenna absolutely free for mentioning WTWW. So go to their website, seacrane.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest, Tim Duffy, K3LR, the Chief Operating Officer of DX Engineering. In the land of mobile antennas, let me ask this question, and you can tell me what your opinion is. What about grounding and bonding? I mean, you know, if the trunk lid is not at ground potential, if it's kind of floating, or the hood, or the doors, or anything like that, do you folks sell anything at all to, like, bring the car all together as one ground?
Yeah, we do. That's a great question, Ted. And that is, I think, the missing secret to making mobile antennas work up to their potential is getting all the metal bonded with low, very, very, very low resistance grounds and connections. And we sell tin copper braid in various widths, with terminals already on them. You know, we've got all the clamps that can get around things. We've got the cleaning stuff that you need to, you know, clean paint or clean corrosion off to make sure that you get the hood and the bumpers and everything grounded together. You know, if you want to take and really get, just squeeze the maximum amount of juice out, we've got kits, you know, to help ground the muffler and do all the things that you should do to really pull all the metal together to use it. I mean, it's a ground on wheels, but it's all you got to work with here.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. I have seen vehicles where a person was running a Hustler. That's what I have observed on like the 40 meter band, even the 80 meter band for that goes. But they would be talking and they would just be really weak, you know. And they would go through the whole rigmarole of grounding the trunk to the trunk of the car to the rest of the body, and they would do all four doors, and they would do the hood and all that, and get everything all connected together with, like you said, copper braid or something like that. And then they'd come back on the air, and wow, what a difference. It was like a completely different signal. It was way up compared to way down, you know. So I guess, you know, even though the things are bolted together, or you would trust that they're bolted together, there still can be resistance to RF there, and you may not have, you may not have the whole car body online as far as the ground is concerned.
It's very true, and when you that half of the antenna is so important. I mean, there are a lot of verticals out there that claim to be, well, we don't need radials, you don't need a good ground, you know. Nobody wants to put in the extra effort to make that ground work, but boy, it pays off when you do. And the same thing is true with these Hustler verticals or Tar Heels on your car. You just simply can't put an antenna on there and expect to get all the performance out of it. The other half of the antenna is the ground. And when it's the car body, just because there's bolts there, I mean, you know, when the car was manufactured, they didn't go through and make sure the paint was all cleared off and the antioxidant there. And, you know, they're not there to make sure that if a ham ends up with this vehicle, that everything is super low resistance bonded together. But that's where the fun of amateur radio comes in. And if you want to have a really effective mobile setup, that's what it takes, you know. And some guys say, no, I don't want to go through all that hassle, and that's fine, and they're happy with what they have. But and you've heard those signals. Sometimes they can be so weak. And then on the other hand, the guy that has got everything bonded together, and he's got, you know, his SWR down, and his radio's happy, and he's got all the grounds in place. And, you know, we have copper strap, too. The same copper strap that you use there in the radio station, we sell, you know, 2-inch strap all over the place, and that is tremendous for low resistance bonding. So there's really no excuse. If you want to get the best signal, that's how you do it.
Well, let me ask this question now. Earlier you had alluded to some products that were preamps, and I recall, you know, years ago being in amateur radio and asking about preamps, you know, saying, well, hey, how much would that help, you know? And you would always get, well, you know, the Bob preamp is it'll bring the noise up with the signal. The ratio's the same. If you can't hear it without the preamp, when you turn the preamp on, it's just going to get louder and the noise is going to get louder. So tell me, is that true? Is that not true?
Well, it is true to a certain extent. This particular preamp that we have, it's our RPA-1, is a best-in-class preamp. It's actually better than most of the front ends in the radios that you find, especially if the radio has been, you know, is 10 years old or older. This particular preamp is a very, very good front end and can really bring signals out of the noise. But the best thing that these preamps are used for is for like that beverage antenna that's got negative gain. It's got good directivity, but it's got negative gain. So This will give you about 18 dB of gain, and it has a it won't get smashed by all the local broadcast signals. It's got a lot of overload capability, and it can really bring life to, you know, a lot of these radios that, again, that were made maybe more than 10 years ago really didn't have enough gain on 10 and 15 meters. And so maybe the S meter doesn't even move when you hook an antenna up to it. And this RPA-1 can bring life to radios that struggle with sensitivity on the higher band. So there's a lot of applications for this preamp, Ted. And we see all sorts of, the shortwave listeners that have small antennas. They might just have a wire inside the house. You know, the signals are there, but they're weak. You put one of these preamps on, and boom, here comes the signals.
How does it? Let me ask you this question: how do these things improve the signal to noise ratio? How do they do that?
Well, what they're going to do is, if the signals are there, it's going to bring up those signals. If all there is noise there, it's going to bring up the noise just the same. It can't differentiate between noise and what is good and what is bad. That's beyond the capabilities of the preamp. That's where you have to get into the noise-canceling controller. But in a lot of cases where a radio or an antenna system has insufficient gain to begin with, it'll bring it up.
Well, I wondered, because, you know, some of the older radios, especially some of the older tube rigs, you know, Drake, TR-4C, Swan 350, Swan 500, I mean, some of the fellows that are wanting to run these classic radios, and they're a little deaf up on the high bands, you know, so I was wondering how much help they were to those rigs.
It can mean, you know, where the band is dead, and then suddenly there's signals because there's 18 dB of gain. You know, those radios just were designed in a time error when, you know, as long as they worked on 80 and 40 and especially 20, there was a lot of afterthought for 15 and 10. This can just bring those radios to life. It really can.
I guess the other thing, too, is, does the preamp, is it intelligent enough to where, how do you switch it? You know, you got coax going into it. Does it automatically know when you're transmitting and, shuts off or bypasses? Or do you have to connect a manual TR-type switch to it?
You would have to connect a manual TR switch, or if your radio has the receive antenna actually broken out so that you can, in a lot of cases, a particular radio will have RX in and RX out, and maybe have a jumper there, and that is a convenient place to put this receive preamp. Down the road, we'll probably have an auto sensing, or, a preamp that'll do automatic bypass keyed off the PTT, you know, off the amplifier relay line. We don't currently have that, but I'll tell you, Ted, we have got a ton of products in development, and that's just one of many. You know, our goal is every year to have more and more products that you can't get anywhere else available, and that this preamp is a game changer for a lot of guys.
Let's talk a minute about satellite communication, or, as far as that goes, even EME. What do you guys have? What do you have in store for all of those guys that are wanting? Like, for example, do you assist hams in getting set up for EME?
We have many customers that are doing EME, and we've got a great line of antennas from M Squared that we sell, and we have amplifiers for 2 meters and 6 meters, where you can make a kilowatt or better on those bands. So we've got the amplifiers to do it. We've got the radios, certainly the ICOM and Kenwood radios that are capable of doing that. And then all the M Squared antennas, they have all the splitters and power dividers and AZL, you know, elevation and azimuth rotation. We've got those rotors. So we can outfit the EME guys and the satellite guys. You know, the same M squared antennas are good for that. There's a lot of handheld antennas that we have through M squared that the satellite guys will use with their HTs and so forth. So, and we've got a couple of guys in the technical team that can talk the talk there. I'm not real strong in that area, but I know the guys that are behind the phones for us are able to do it.
Well, from the standpoint of amateurs that are wanting to get into, say, for example, let's talk EME first. I guess my question is what's the bare bones that you can get into it? You know, just to reflect the signal off the moon, hear it come back. Impress the kids and the family, you know. Well, what would you consider entry level? I mean, how much power does it take? How many Yagis are you going to have? Or, you know, what's the minimum?
Well, you know, K1JT, Joe Taylor, who's a Nobel Peace, Nobel laureate, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics several years ago, wrote a program called JT65 that is used as a game changer in the EME business and allows guys with just one or two antennas, long boom antennas on 2 meters in particular, to do moon bounce with relatively low power without having to go to a kilowatt. You can do it down in the 200 watt level, the 150 watt level. So, you know, a brick type amplifier and a high gain antenna using this JT65 software. It's digital communication. So you see it on the screen. You can see your echoes coming off of the moon, and you can work guys this way. And Ted, you can't even hear the signals. It's down. It's digital signal processing in the sound card. And you can make EME QSOs that you can't even hear the stuff because the digital signal processing power is so cool and so well done in the computer. But that is really a game changer. Now, if you want to use CW, you have to have more power and you have to have more antenna to do that. But the great thing is there's a lot of EME guys out there that have the big power and they have the big antennas. So they can be, you know, this is all about path loss, and they can make up for some of your small size, and you can work some of those guys. But JT65 as the digital communications format, just it changed EME. It's been around for at least 7-8 years. And I've seen it done, and I was just amazed because I couldn't hear it. Couldn't hear what was going on, but there it was printing across the screen.
That's that's totally amazing. What about digital modes? Do you have what do you guys have that can get guys into the digital modes that have never fooled with them? You know, I mean, what do you have on board?
Well, you know, the Signal Link, Tigertronics has this box. It's a magic box called the Signal Link, and it does all the digital stuff. You know, everything from packet to JT65 to Olivia. It does all the pack tours. It does standard RIDI, does all the digital formats, and it's $100.
And okay, now is this little box to describe? I think I have one, but I'm not sure. I haven't had a chance to even fool with it. Is this a device like it plugs into the USB port on your computer?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So then I thought that thing was just a little remote sound card that you used for your radio. But the software does all the work on the computer. Is that it's at least that's what right. I was thinking. Okay.
Yes.
Well, go ahead. Keep going. Keep going. Let me hear this.
It is a sound card. It is a remote sound card, but it's got software with it, so it can do all the digital formats, receive, transmit, cable it up to your radio, and in less than a half an hour, you're on every digital mode you could think of. And so for $100, it's really incredible. And we have the cables for just about any radio under the sun. And so you got cables, the signal link, a radio, and a computer. You're on.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, I know, I think, I don't know if both of my sons have done this or not. I think Matt has. I don't know if David did. But they have one. Matt's got one, and I've got one. It seems like Matt got all excited about the first time he went on some sort of a digital mode, and he called me up. He said, "Oh, you wouldn't believe this, and I'm only running so many watts, and it's, I'm getting this." You know. So it was a real trip for him. I remember years ago, the people would guys would keep their Model 15 and TU units on 2 meters. And they would send messages back and forth all day long, and of course it would print out. So you'd come home, and you may have 15 messages on your machine, or you may have a picture of one of the presidents or something. In the digital modes now, are there fixed frequencies that everybody gangs up on that frequency, and they all exchange information, and it goes out almost like a net, you know, but it's digital?
Oh yeah, there's. Especially on places like 20 meters and 40 meters, you know, in that area, I would say on 40 from 70, 65, all the way up to 7100, there's, you know, various different digital formats being used, from RIDI to PSK to Olivia and JT65 and FL Digi. You'll find them all in there. And, you know, obviously there are nets and activity areas that are dedicated for various purposes. It's different than when you were leaving the Model 15 on 2 meters, but in a lot of cases, the idea is the same. It's still using a keyboard-to-keyboard communication. In this case, you know, when you've got the computer involved, you can do more automation with it, but I'll tell you what, Ted, it is one of the most popular areas of HF operating is the digital modes. It really is.
You know, it's strange. You know, I was talking to, you know, my sons about running a Model 15. And I think, wasn't there a Model 18 or 17, something a couple of model numbers up from the from the 15. And I can't remember now. But there was also a... another teletype unit called the Kleinschmidt. And if you found one of those things, it usually came with a table. You know, there's a table and this perforator thing sat on there, and the actual teletype machine sat over. But, you know, what's interesting is I've been the last 2 years I've been to Dayton, unless I'm just not looking in the right places, I didn't see one single Model 15 out there in the flea market. So I guess, you know, and I thought it would be kind of cool to get one and see if you couldn't make it work, you know, with some of the new digital devices that would feed the data to it, the mark and space and all that other stuff that you feed to it, you know, so that you could demonstrate the old Model 15. Of course, I don't know where you'd get ribbons and paper for it. You know, that might be another problem. But I didn't see a single Model 15 or a Kleinschmidt out there in the flea market area. So, you know, what do you think's going on? I mean, are the aliens coming from other planets and buying all those things up?
You know, unfortunately, I think a lot of them end up at the dump. You know, guys have said, geez, it's tough to find the parts, and it's tough to keep them going, and it's a lot easier to just use a computer to do the same thing. However, I am absolutely certain that there are still a lot of guys that have them that can make parts or have enough in the boneyard to keep them running, and you know, they'll be in museums and things like that. But I also believe that it takes a lot of huffing around to bring that thing to Dayton, and if it's just going to sit there all weekend and nobody's going to buy it, and then you got to hoof it all the way back home. You know, you might have better luck finding one of those on eBay and having somebody drive in with the truck and the forklift and, you know, 8 guys in a bus, because, you know, that thing was real heavy. So I think, unfortunately, and it breaks my heart, and I know it breaks your heart, that some of these things ended up in the dump. But I also believe that there's a dedicated group of guys that understand how they work. It's nostalgic to them. It's important to them, and they're keeping them running. But I think those numbers are dwindling all the time.
Yeah, because I haven't seen anything. But then again, too, I was supposed to at Dayton. Most of my time is spent on the air, you know, and interviewing people, and we're on in 4-hour, 5-hour stretches on, you know, for 3 days out there. So it's like I don't get to see too much of anything. I get out in the boneyard and walk around a little bit and find things. It was really weird. One year, I found an 811 linear amplifier out there that I had built when I was like 17 or 18 years of age, and it was out there in the boneyard. I could not believe it. You know, I don't know what happened to that amp. I just remember building it, and then it was just gone. You know, I mean, so much equipment like that. It's like I can't remember what happened to my old Ico 753. And people say, well, why would you worry about that? You know, but I don't remember. I had an SX-101. I don't know where that went. Had an HT-37, gone. Have no memory of what happened to that radio. You know, are you like that, or is it just me?
No, you know, and now that we've gotten older, we'd like to have all that stuff back. You know, at the time, we needed to raise cash to get the next radio or to go to college or whatever, you know, the pressing need for money was at the moment. But yeah, there's a Heathkit SB-102 that I built when I was 14 years old that I dearly would love to get back. Fortunately, I hung on to my novice station, my Johnson Adventurer and my Heathkit HR-10B. But, you know, and then, you know, those Drake lines, I loved those Drake lines and I sold them all and then I went and bought them all back. I couldn't live without them.
Well,
still have them stacked up.
The HR-10B, now tell me, was that receiver deaf or not?
I can't believe I worked anybody with it. You know, I guess that's when men were men, but, you know, I thought when my father spent $50 to get that HR-10B, it was a used receiver, and I can remember, you know, I mean, I worked stations on 15 meters with it and lots of stations on 40. But then I managed to, you know, I had a paper route, and I saved up enough when I was 13 to get a Drake 2C. And I thought, my God, all the stuff I've been missing. This is, you know, the magic of Miamisburg, Ohio. So that Drake 2C and I got, you know, I was trying to fall in love with girls, but I had a lot more love going on for my Drake 2C, and then I upgraded to the Heathkit DX60 and had my single 6146, and man, I was living.
You know, I've still got TR4Cs here, and the thing that has driven me, that transceiver, I don't know what it is that's consistent about it, but that doggone relay in there, not the little tiny TR relay, but the main contactor that's in there right about midship on the bottom that runs off of a, I forget what the tube is, 6EU7 or something. I have yet to see one. Every time I get one of those rigs, the first thing, I operate maybe for about a month, and all of a sudden that relay goes, and then the thing, when you key it, it goes into transmit, will not come back to receive unless you turn the power off. And so I guess I need to find tubes. I need to replace, I think it's a tube. I had somebody say, well, you can put a resistor in series with the plate that pulls the relay in, but I don't want to modify the radio. I guess I'd just like to replace the tube. But that was the only curse that I ever found about those, other than them being a little deaf on 10 and 15. I don't know if you found the same thing.
Yeah, they were a little deaf. The very first amateur radio I ever saw was the Drake TR-3, so it was a predecessor, that TR-4. And those side view mirrors, or not mirrors, but meters on that radio was just magic. Seeing, you know, the S meter move on those side view meters was just unbelievable to me. And I I'll never, ever forget that. But, you know, a lot of tubes in a TR-3 and a TR-4 and a lot of moving parts. So, and, you know, tubes are of that vintage are a little hard to find, but it's not impossible. You know, and at Dayton every year there's the Drake Forum. And, you know, Jeff Cavelli, W-A-8-S-A-J, who lives just north of DX Engineering, he's one of those Drake aficionados, and he runs that Drake Forum, and there's a lot of TR-4s on the air. Boy, do they sound good, Ted. They really do.
Oh, I've got several here, and I use a D-104 on them. A lot of people use the Shures, the Shure 444 or something like that, but I'm using the D-104. And, you know, I'll go from an ICOM 746 with a Heil mic on it, and I'll jump on the TR-4C, and immediately the person says, wow, the audio on that radio really sounds nice. So I don't know. And the D-104 is such a harsh-sounding microphone, but I guess because of the tubes and even order harmonics that are a result of using tube audio, probably adds to the mystique or the sound of the Drake line.
It's one of a kind, you know. The Collins S line had great audio, but the Drake boy is just so smooth, and you know, without a lot of fooling around. You know, you'll hear some of these guys on 20 meters with all their stacks of audio processing and everything that. With a solid state rig, and then somebody will come by with a Drake T4XC or a TR4, and they'll sound every bit as good, if not better. So it is that warmth, and, you know, sort of high fidelity, nice bandwidth, and lots of lows, and just the right amount of highs that just punched right through.
Well, I know that on you know, I just was sitting and fooling one night, and I was comparing a pair of the Drake Twins, the TX4 and the R4C, up against the ICOM 746 and also an ICOM 718, just going back and forth and looking, you know. And boy, they hold their own. I mean, they really do. I mean, it's amazing. I prefer the audio of the Drake Twins over the ICOM audio, but boy, it's a close tie. Let me put it that way, you know. But the thing of it is you start moving up in frequency and you start getting up to 15 meters. Of course, they don't have 17 on them. And but as you start going up, they start going a little deaf, you know. So it's not like at least when the ICOM radios have very hot receive on those higher bands. At least that's what it seems like to me. But anyways, let me say this. Tell me, you know, all we've talked about here is this has been DX Engineering all the way. Are you willing to come back and give us your own personal ham radio story at some point in time? Because we're just about out of time, and I'd love to do that.
Yeah, I'd love to, Ted. I think I have a pretty good story of 43 years in the hobby, and you know, having this year at the Dayton Hamvention being the 2015 Ham of the Year, I think I've got a good story to tell, and we can talk about you know, some of the things that I've done in the hobby.
They don't give that Ham of the Year award away to just anybody now, you know.
That's right.
You've got to have
That's
a story.
What I've been told.
And, you know, we should have gone there to start with, but I you know, I just started talking about DX Engineering, and you're just going to have to come back. But let me ask you this, okay? And considering, too, you know, taking into consideration getting the award of Ham of the Year at Dayton and your involvement in the hobby, which obviously go back a long ways when we start talking about comp reamps and clip reamps and DX Engineering speech processors. What do you think, or what do you see right now, and we have just a little bit of time left, as the direction this hobby is going in? What do you feel about amateur radio? Where are we headed?
You know, I really think that we're headed into an exciting time surrounding emergency communications and emergency preparedness. And I think, you know, 9/11 was such a game changer in a lot of ways. You know, Department of Homeland Security didn't exist until after 9/11. And I think the real lure for a lot of people getting involved and getting active is in the area of emergency communications. And, you know, when all else fails, amateur radio is there. So I really see that draw and the marriage, continued marriage of these digital communications methods like mesh networking and satellite communications and microwave experimentation as really the foundation for providing this backbone communication providing that we've been so good at for so long. But I think that, you know, we live in a different time now with a lot of, there can be a lot of problems on the fly. And I really think emergency preparedness is what is going to drive amateur radio for the next 20, 30, 40 years. I think HF communications will always be there. Amateur radio is booming in Europe. And so there's lots of guys on the air to talk to and work. And every weekend there's a contest or a special operating event or a special event station to work so you can get awards and do all those sorts of things. But I really feel strongly that emergency communications is where it's at. And, you know, when we come back here at some point in the future, Ted, we can talk about that because I'm also the section manager for Western Pennsylvania. And deeply involved in emergency communications and net operations. And I got to tell you, it's alive and well and growing like a weed.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been really interesting. I've learned a whole lot about a bunch of stuff that I'm going to have to buy. Things I can't live without, you know. And I really appreciate you sharing all the technical information that you have with us. It's we don't do too much. I guess I want to say we don't do a lot of technical stuff on QSO, but you make it very interesting, and you also present it at a level where anyone can understand it and take it home with them. And I think that's really the important thing. But thank you so much, and yes, you will have to come back.
Ted, thanks very much for inviting me to be on your show. It was a true pleasure, and I really enjoyed the dialogue back and forth with you here. And I look forward to a future QSO on QSO.
There you go. Thank you. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you will get the portable, retractable wire antenna absolutely free for mentioning WTWW. So go to their website, seacrane.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there. And other information, but go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we've got for QSO today. We invite you to follow us on Twitter, friend us on Facebook. Tune in again next week, same time, same station for QSO. Special thanks to our guest, Tim Duffy, K3LR, the Chief Operating Officer of DX Engineering. 73s.